Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. It's a difficult time to be in farming and manufacturing. Concerns over the economy and tariffs are making the situation more uncertain. The Illinois Manufacturers Association's president joins us to talk more about it. We'll learn about an effort to strengthen civics education in Illinois schools. A deaf professor at one university teaches sign language and tells us why she enjoys sharing her knowledge. A Palestinian student in Illinois balances the excitement of college with concerns over violence against her community. Emergency room visits can be more problematic when a patient suffers from dementia. Experts say as the population ages, this will only get worse. And fewer farmers raise crops used for popcorn. We'll visit with some of them who still do. Those stories and more on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Many Illinois manufacturers remain cautious about the current economy because of tariffs. Mark Densler is president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association, and he told Eric Stock his group recently went to Washington with dozens of manufacturers. They urged the Trump administration to help them prepare for an uncertain future and constantly changing present.
Manufacturers want certainty and stability and predictability. And one of the big challenges that we've seen from the president and the administration are turning tariffs on or off, first of all. American manufacturers can compete with anyone across the world if they have a level playing field. And certainly tariffs are appropriate when you have actors such as China who are cheating or dumping steel or stealing intellectual property. The concern of these broad-based tariffs across everybody, a lot of concern about why tariffs are on some of our allies like Canada or Mexico, for example. They're going to remain. In the first Trump administration, they implemented some tariffs. President Biden then kept them. And so, number one, that's been a little bit of a challenge. There haven't been the exemptions that you saw before for certain products. It's certainly a challenge. There's a court case by a toy manufacturer in Chicago that's going to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court here in a month or two. That might provide some additional guidance, but it certainly increased cost. Companies are making the decision, do we pass those on to our customers? Do we absorb those costs and still trying to navigate those waters?
Are you aware of any company that has had to cut back on staff or production or anything like that? Or are they just, like you said, absorbing it as long as they can?
We have. I don't want to mention any companies specifically, but yeah, so some companies have reduced CapEx spending. They have not hired new, or they put a freeze on hiring new people. Particularly when we see companies that are making a product that's sold to consumers. You think food products, for example. You know, a lot of times they don't want to pass those on to consumers. They don't want to lose market share. We've really seen struggles in the ag sector. We're located in the middle of Illinois. We're a leading producer of corn and soybeans. We're in the middle of harvest right now. But when you look at the ag sector, we lost some markets during the first round of tariffs in the first Trump administration that haven't fully come back. Now farmers have higher input costs when it comes to seed and fertilizer and chemicals. At the same time, metals are more expensive. So commodity prices are down. The farmer's not making as much money. Their costs are going up. It's more expensive to buy that tractor or that combine. So really the ag sector is really and particularly struggling right now.
So was it the Manufacturers Association's pitch to scale them back, eliminate them, or keep certain ones like China, as you mentioned?
Well, ideally, we'd love to have trade agreements with countries. I think the president and the administration announced 8 or 9 trade agreements now. They're working on more. And so really what we want are trade agreements with countries. And then in the event that someone breaks a trade agreement, then you have tariffs as a possible penalty to make sure that they adhere to that. And so ultimately, that would be the best case situation. And when we were in Washington meeting with members of the congressional delegation and meeting with the U.S. Department of Commerce and the Trade Administration, you know, we were telling them the stories, or companies were talking about the stories of whether they had increased costs. We have one company that now sources everything in the United States, and they've been told when they want to sell to Canada, that Canada says, we want you to have more Canadian suppliers. So it's putting this company at a little bit of a crossroads where if they want to sell more to Canada, they have to have Canadian suppliers. If they want to sell in the United States, they have to have U.S. suppliers. So is that a case where they're going to have to make two different products based on supply, which creates an issue for them?
And how much influence do you feel that you and the other associations working on this may have with the administration, in particular the president, who largely seems to be doing this on his own?
We certainly have influence with lawmakers. You know, we met with Eric Sorensen while we were there, met with Darren LaHood.
But do they have the influence that you hope they have?
Right. I mean, they certainly have influence. Darren probably a little bit more so, being a Republican, and mm-hmm. President Trump being a Republican. But we've got good, the IMA in particular has very good relationships with the U.S. Department of Commerce because we've known some of the folks for a long time. Senior advisor to the secretary actually used to work for the National Association of Manufacturers, so we've known him for many years. So we have, we talk to him on a regular basis and have that line of communication. But certainly the president makes decisions in different ways than previous administrations have made. And, you know, his heart is what he said is he wants more manufacturing here. It's something that we agree with. And I think everybody in the United States, Republican and Democrat, want more manufacturing here. It really is what's the path to get there.
How realistic is it to bring more manufacturing jobs, to build more plants, to not have to rely so much on China and other places that we are not friendly with? How practical can that happen? How long of a game are we talking about?
Well, it's certainly, you don't flip a switch and have manufacturers that are starting operations tomorrow. And so it's a long-term strategy. The United States has really never had an industrial policy in their history, unlike what you see in China, for example, or other countries. And we really started creating industrial policy under former President Biden with the Inflation Reduction Act and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Bill. President Trump kind of has his view of what a manufacturing industrial policy looks like. And so as we map that out, I certainly think, particularly with the supply chain issue that happened in COVID, we're really seeing now, I think, a concerted effort to build facilities here, to expand facilities here, to make sure we're not so reliant on supply chains that are global. But at the same time, 95% of the world's consumers live outside the United States. And so there has to be a recognition that sometimes it's easier to build a particularly a large product, to build it overseas, to ship it because they're close to the customers. And I think I'm really bullish on new manufacturing. I think we're going to see growth here. I think Illinois and the industrial Midwest are primed, access to water being one of the key issues on that we didn't talk about. But I do think we're going to see continued manufacturer growth.
Mark Densler is president of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. He spoke with Eric Stock. Katie Moore teaches American Sign Language classes at SIU Carbondale. It's nothing out of the ordinary when it comes to teaching a new language, but it is a topic close to her heart. Brian Sapp reports.
This is the sound of Katie Moore's American Sign Language class at SIU. She begins class with review. She points to a word and the students move their hands and practice facial expressions to make the correct sign. It's nothing out of the ordinary when it comes to teaching a new language, but this is a topic close to the heart of Assistant Professor Katie Moore. You see, Katie is deaf, having lost her hearing around the age of 4. For this interview, she signs the responses to my questions, quietly mouthing the words, and Aaron Stump helps with the translating. Katie is starting her second year at SIU as one of 2 deaf professors on a team of 3 teaching ASL and deaf culture at the university. Teaching students is not where Katie expected to be, but
I feel like this is what I enjoy doing. I want to make a difference with my students, and I feel like I can do that.
This May, Katie received her doctorate from the University of Illinois, always a big accomplishment. But when you look at the statistics, you can see how big it really is. According to data by the National Deaf Center, deaf people earn post-secondary degrees at half the rate of the hearing population. In 2023, 23% of deaf people earned bachelor's degrees compared to 38% of hearing people. That gap widens as the degree level advances. For example, 2% of deaf people earn doctorates compared to 4% of those who can hear. While the number seems stark, Katie explains the reasons behind the disparity that the numbers can't tell you.
There's a lot of imposter syndrome. Being good enough, being smart enough. There's a lot of people who have told me throughout my life that I'm not smart, that I won't be successful. So that had a big impact on me and in my experience. Another is interpreting, accessibility. With my PhD level work in education, you can't just hire any interpreter because the interpreter is my voice. If that interpreter chooses the wrong word, if they're not a good fit for my level, then it affects how people view me.
The difficulties Katie faced in junior high and high school prepared her to handle these challenges. She eventually attended and graduated high school from the Illinois School for the Deaf in Jacksonville, Illinois.
I was exposed to deaf culture, which was incredible for me. When I went into the School for the Deaf, I started meeting other people that were just like me. They had their own culture, their own language. It was like being in a different world, and I couldn't believe it.
From there, she went on to earn her bachelor's degree from U of I. And like many graduates, she wasn't sure what she wanted to do. An internship with Disney brought out her desire to interact with people. While working a job completing real estate title work, Katie was approached by a former teacher about a job teaching sign language to high schoolers. She felt that she wasn't ready to tackle teaching, but if no one took the job she learned, they would get rid of the ASL classes.
I had no teacher training, nothing. So I said, okay, fine, I'll try. We'll see what happens. And I fell in love with it. I just fell in love with teaching. So I taught at Jacksonville High School for 6 years.
This newfound love led her to expand her knowledge of teaching, pursuing a master's and then a doctorate degree, all in the hope of expanding her impact on her students and the deaf community.
My experience with not having full language access and having to get by with communication, I think has made me a better teacher because I understand and I want to work with students. I want to help them understand the deaf experience, what those frustrations are, what the barriers are.
Katie doesn't shy away when I ask her if she sees herself as an inspiration for other deaf people.
I'm out there. I want other deaf people to see it and know it's not impossible. And there's several reasons. There's barriers, there's the imposter syndrome, interpreters, language access. I think right now, people are seeing it through social media, which has had a huge impact. Before, you would never see deaf people. You never saw signing. And now we're much more visible. I think that's made a big difference. Hopefully, those people who are saying, oh, I can't, are getting more examples and are spurred on to get their degree because they see that other people have done it, so they can do it too.
And back in class, it's been a quiet 55 minutes. But in that time, there's been a snowball fight, learning, giggling, and all ending with a goodbye from Katie telling her students to have a fun weekend. I'm Brian Sapp.
The popcorn harvest is underway across the Midwest. Lots of towns hold popcorn festivals this time of year or even claim to be the popcorn capitals of the world. The U.S. Department of Agriculture data shows fewer than 1,000 popcorn farms exist. Harvest Public Media contributor Sheila Bremer introduces us to a few people and places where popcorn is more than a treat, it's a living.
During a vacation to Mount Rushmore, David McAvoy from Tennessee stops by a tourist attraction off the beaten path in Sac City, Iowa.
Pretty awesome. I mean, when you think about 9,000 pounds of popcorn, that's pretty cool.
It's the world's largest popcorn ball, encased behind glass and more than 8 feet tall. A monument to a rural way of life.
All you see when you're driving is corn everywhere, so you can make all kinds of popcorn.
Actually, McAvoy likely didn't see popcorn. Most farmers raise field corn. Even in nearby Shaler, called the popcorn capital of the world, very few growers remain. However, they still celebrate with an annual popcorn festival, including a parade, rides, and plenty of free popcorn.
Pouring the oil in right now. And then here goes the popcorn.
Volunteers like Jared Curry and his wife and two daughters hand out hundreds of bags full.
I did a little math, too, and I figured out we'll probably go through about 400 pounds over the weekend.
Even though Iowa shows pride in popcorn, the state no longer leads the country.
There's been cases where they flip back and forth, but Indiana and Nebraska are the top two popcorn-producing states.
That's corn expert Dan Quinn with Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. The USDA reports that Indiana currently grows and produces the most popcorn. And Quinn says a majority of people don't give the crop much thought.
You know, there's a lot of people that go to the movie theater, right, that I think they just don't understand the magnitude of where popcorn is grown, the importance of it to a lot of farmers, and also the amount of research and work that goes into it.
Quinn says since popcorn is non-GMO or not genetically modified, it's more susceptible to bugs, weeds, and weather. These challenges mean farmers aren't always eager to grow the whole grain. In fact, the Census of Agriculture shows out of almost 2 million farms in the United States, only 860 raise popcorn. Jack Hogue knows popcorn. He's been in the business on his Northwest Iowa farm for more than 50 years, like his father before him. He checks his field, a sea of green waving leaves, and says things are looking good.
We're really fortunate this year. Corn here is about 7 to 7.5 feet tall. We've just had so much rain this spring. We've been so blessed to have rain.
Hogue contracts his harvest to the American Popcorn Company, the makers of Jolly Time, one of the country's most recognized brands. President Steve Huizenga gives a tour of the operation in Sioux City, Iowa.
You'll see two shots of corn, two shots of oil. They're basically running.
They sell between 50 and 60 million pounds a year, or as Huizenga counts, 90 billion kernels.
Popcorn is still kind of that snack that brings people together, right? And it's about happy memories and about doing things with family and friends and even me time. You know, sometimes it's just nice to sit and have popcorn by yourself. That hasn't changed.
It's the love of popcorn and nostalgia that keeps North Loop in central Nebraska on the map.
We're a town of 280 people. That's how big we are. And we put on quite a celebration.
Larry White helps organize the community's annual popcorn days, turning 125 years old next summer.
We had a good one this year. It was hotter than blazes. We had a very good turnout. We seem like we're adding something new every year.
It's the longest running event of its kind in the state and possibly the country, featuring everything from rodeo events, entertainment, to wiener dog races. And of course, the main attraction, popcorn.
I've had more people say, it's free? You know, it's kind of like, yes, it's free popcorn.
But even if it doesn't cost any green in a small town in the Cornhusker state, the U.S. popcorn industry as a whole is worth about $3 billion. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Sheila Brummer.
Providing better education when it comes to civics. That story is just ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Nearly 100 Illinois high schools are part of an initiative to strengthen civics education. Peter Medlin went to their annual conference to talk about how democracy schools can help when 3/4 of Americans think democracy is under serious threat.
Intense polarization, wrenching political violence, AI breeding new modes of misinformation. What students see every day barely resembles what they traditionally read in a civics textbook. So it's time for a new way forward. That's according to Mary Ellen Daniels, longtime civics teacher and founder of Democracy Schools. And she believes their schools can meet the moment and be a model for kids and their communities.
This isn't just a social studies thing. This isn't just a citizenship test, but it's thinking about how all teachers and all adults in a building send messages about how our republic works.
Democracy Schools started 20 years ago with a few schools in the Chicago suburbs, and it's now a network of over 90 throughout the state. And it's also expanding out of Illinois. They're working with Wisconsin and Indiana to create programs, and the recent conference featured teachers from across the Midwest and as far as Hawaii, all looking to follow Illinois' lead in civics. So what exactly does a democracy school look like? Daniil says media literacy is crucial, and they also simulate democratic processes through things like the legislative semester class, where students act as lawmakers and pass bills.
Some of those tools are things like current and controversial issue discussions. How do we navigate some of these issues that divide us?
But it's not just teaching students how government works, it's about participating in government. Daniil says that while polarization is toxic nationally, locally they can get to know decision makers and make their voice heard.
That's actually more real for kids. The local government that decides where the skate park is, that decides the policies at their schools.
In Western Illinois, Spoon River Valley has been a democracy school for 3 years, where Jennifer Burdett says it has transformed her classroom. Her students feel democracy literacy by having a hand in their own school's budget process.
And the students got $2,000 to spend for the school district, and they had to vote on things. They led that whole initiative. They met with administration. They told administration what their thoughts were. And then ultimately, we put those into place. We have a coffee shop now that runs in our school because it was a student-created initiative.
Spoon River Valley is also on the cutting edge of Democracy School's next move, expanding to middle and elementary schools. With the emergence of AI and other new tech, Burdette's been helping teach media literacy to fifth graders.
It's a skill set that we have to explicitly teach, and we have to start it younger and younger because they're getting technology younger and younger.
Americans don't agree on much, but one thing just about everyone agrees on is that teaching students to be good citizens should be a priority.
Civic knowledge is remarkably, you know, concerningly low, right? Where something like 3 in 10 people could pass the U.S. naturalization test.
That's Sean Healy. He presented at the conference and used to teach civics alongside Daniels, but now works on policy with iCivics, which creates civics games and activities used by millions of students in the U.S.
We really hollowed out civic education. Some of that happened during my time, right? Particularly with No Child Left Behind and this kind of exclusive focus on reading and math. It crowded out everything else from the curriculum.
He's right. In the first 5 years after No Child Left Behind passed in 2002, across the country, schools slashed social studies and civics instruction by 32%, with some schools cutting it in half. That's according to a report from the Center on Education Policy. But Healy says it's improving. States are investing more in civics. 36 states, including Illinois, require a standalone high school course. And since 2018, he says 12 states have passed civics requirements for middle school. So just about everyone agrees we should teach students to be good citizens. But the question is, what exactly does that look like? Well, a survey from the University of Southern California shows most Americans believe students should learn about the Constitution, identifying false information online, finding community solutions, and debating opposing views, all principles of democracy schools. But Healy says that doesn't mean teaching civics is always easy.
If you go back a quarter century, teachers had a ton of autonomy in terms of how they taught civics. Now there is incredible scrutiny. So it's politically fraught in many places to teach civics nowadays.
Illinois State Superintendent Tony Sanders spoke at the conference, and he says it's harder to teach about elections when President Trump posts debunked election fraud conspiracies. And he worries it makes students lose even more trust in the democratic process.
There's never been a more important time in our history to be teaching civic education. I have a real fear that the rhetoric of election rigging and the rhetoric of, well, anything having to do with election, even having National Guard potentially coming into the city of Chicago or any state, and the effect that has on repressing votes.
The U.S. Department of Education recently announced a new America 250 Civics Education Coalition. Its launch video isn't as much about a lack of civic knowledge and engagement as it is about a lack of perceived patriotism in classrooms.
A great institution has been crumbled from within, overtaken by those who teach hatred for America, false revisionist history, and division.
The coalition's made up of right-wing groups like the Heritage Foundation and PragerU, and they say there'll be a speaking tour, student competitions, and teacher summits. And at the announcement of the coalition, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said she believes to teach civics is to teach students to love America. She cited a poll from this year stating that 41% of Gen Z say they're extremely or very proud to be an American.
Why aren't they proud to be Americans? It's because they don't know America. We haven't taught them about America. They don't know our history. They don't know the trials and tribulations that led to this being the most wonderful country on the face of the earth.
Here in Illinois, Democracy School's Mary Ellen Daniels says civics isn't a red or blue issue. She says their civics education work helps students engage in reflective patriotism.
Look honestly at some of our past failures, but also give kids those tools to reflect on how we've improved and how we can do better in the future.
And for all of Illinois' civics investment, is it working? Engaging in civics in your community is a lifelong mission, but how do they know that message is getting through to students? Sean Healy with iCivics says they worked with a research group a few years ago to figure out if Illinois' mandated high school civics courses were having an impact.
We found, for example, that young people that took this class were more likely to vote. They were more likely to discuss political issues. They were more likely to volunteer. So that is impact, right?
Healy says he thinks the country's probably as politically polarized as it's been since the Civil War. He and the people at democracy schools think that one of the main ways out of this is through stronger civics education. I'm Peter Medlin.
The National Organization for Women has a new president. She grew up in Western Illinois and was involved with the Illinois State Chapter of NOW for many years. Rich Egger tells us about her.
When a parent is a political science professor, you just might find yourself discussing politics at home. That was the case for Kim Villanueva as she grew up in Macomb. Her father, A.B. Villanueva, taught political science at Western Illinois University for 30 years.
I remember when I was little, the Watergate hearings were going on.
The family would watch those hearings on TV and then talk about what was happening. She says their member of Congress at the time was Republican Tom Railsback, who was on the House committee that was investigating Watergate.
So that was sort of brought it home for me that, you know, what happens outside in the big world comes back into this little small town of Macomb.
Villanueva says even though Macomb is a small town, it was pretty cosmopolitan because of the university.
There was quite a diverse student body, and my dad's colleagues in the department were from different political perspectives, but they were also geographically diverse and from different countries.
Her father brought some of that geographical diversity to the department. He immigrated to the U.S. from the Philippines. Kim Villanueva went on to study journalism at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in the early 1980s. That's also where she became involved with NOW. It started with a journalism class assignment. Students had to come up with their own beat and report stories about it. So she created the Women's Issues beat. Her professor was not sold on it initially.
He was a little skeptical, but I think he admitted that I did find topics to write about. You know, women were just starting to get in the workforce, and so I would write stories about women who had to find childcare so they could work.
As part of the class, Villanueva talked to some women from NOW about the Illinois legislature's failure to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. The women encouraged her to attend a NOW meeting. After graduating and moving to Springfield, Villanueva sought out the local NOW chapter and has been involved with the organization ever since. She believes progress has been made on women's issues during her lifetime, but is concerned some of that progress is being rolled back.
I think we're seeing, certainly recent Supreme Court decisions, you know, the Dobbs decision, you know, moving the right to abortion back to the states was a huge blow for women and women's health care.
While Villanueva has concerns on the national level, she says Illinois has made advances on pay equity, family leave, and child care issues. She says Illinois was also ahead of the curve on passing marriage equality laws. As NOW's national president, Villanueva says she will work to raise awareness of issues such as reproductive health and stopping violence against women, and they want to amplify those issues in red states such as Indiana. Villanueva was in Indiana recently for the 46th annual Valparaiso Popcorn Festival. She says people cheered and waved to the NOW contingent as they marched in the festival's parade.
So we're just trying to get out and say, you know, you may not identify as a feminist, but if you agree with equal rights and that women should be paid equally and that they should have the right to control their bodies, then you are a feminist. That's what it's all about.
Villanueva says growing up in Macomb gave her a common sense perspective. She says it helped her realize that it's good just to sit down and talk to people. Even if you disagree, you need to be willing to listen. Villanueva says she's respectful of others' opinions, but will stand her ground when she needs to. Rich Egger reporting.
A public meeting in Urbana last weekend explored the historical and ongoing hurt of Black Americans in Illinois, with a call to action for reparations. Juliana Means with Illinois Public Media reports.
Community members gathered at the Krannert Center to hear speakers make the case for reparations, petitioning to help Black Americans heal through compensation. University of Illinois professor Sundiata Chajua spoke about stolen labor and hindered opportunity. He says reparations for African Americans is not individual, but for a nation of people that do not have a state.
So what we want to talk about is collective reparation, reparation to communities and reparations to the African-American people, as well as individual payments.
This event is one of six public hearings hosted by the State of Illinois African Descent Citizens Reparation Commission. I'm Juliana Means, IPM News.
Long emergency room waits in the U.S. are common, especially for older patients. Some wait for many hours or even days before they get a hospital bed. In cooperation with the Associated Press, Side Effects Public Media's Ben Thorpe reports experts say things will only get worse as the country braces for a silver tsunami. That is an aging population that may come with complex diseases and more dementia cases.
Tracy Bolhan flips through old photos of her dad, Bill Spear, at their vacation home in Indiana. In one photo, her father wears a t-shirt in front of a sweaty bucket of beers.
He does have my shirt on. Yeah, Pop's the man, the myth, the legend.
Bolhan misses her dad. She even keeps some of his old voicemails.
I gotta know what I need to complain about. Can you help me? I gotta know.
Spear passed away last year after a long struggle with dementia. They routinely ended up in the emergency room. During one stay, he spent 12 hours in the ER of Endeavor Health in Naperville, Illinois, waiting for a psych evaluation.
He was strapped down. There was nothing he could do. So he was fighting, like banging his head, you know, like doing the things where he was kind of thrashing around in the bed.
The hospital said they wouldn't comment on Spear's experience, citing patient privacy. Bolhan didn't know it then, but her dad's ER experience is so common it has a name, ER boarding. In 2022, the most recent year we have data for, 3 million visits to an ER that led to a hospital admission had a wait of 4 hours or longer before getting a regular hospital bed. That's according to an analysis by the Associated Press and Side Effects Public Media. Data suggests that half of the patients who were boarded were 65 or older. Experts say, at this rate, it's unlikely things will get better.
The population is substantially older. People have way more complicated illnesses. There are people living longer and longer with the complexities of having had cancer, congestive heart failure, chronic lung disease.
That's Arjun Venkatesh, who studies emergency medicine at Yale. Other experts warn of a silver tsunami of patients that will hit ERs. That's because the rates of dementia in the U.S. are expected to grow over the next few decades. Venkatesh says part of the problem is a lack of staffed hospital beds.
So we have about just as many hospital beds in America today as we did 20 years ago. The reason that's a problem is that emergency department visits are up 30 to 40% over that time.
And he says hospitals tend to prioritize scheduled care patients, whose insurance companies will reimburse them for things like cancer care and orthopedic surgeries. That means that there aren't incentives to bring patients from backed up ERs into a hospital bed on another floor. That leaves patient caregivers in a tough spot. They say when they're in crisis, they don't know where else to go besides the ER.
It's where you end up because it's like, what do I do? It's an acute behavior. I need to do something.
This is Nancy Frageau. In 2024, she took her husband, Michael Riemann, to the emergency room in Kankakee, Illinois, three separate times. One of those times led to an emergency room stay longer than 10 hours waiting for specialized care.
You know, it's hard enough for anyone to be in the ER, but I cannot imagine someone with dementia being in there because that was so hard for him. I was there most of the time, and he just kept saying, when am I going? What's happening? Because he didn't understand.
Frageau and most of the families we spoke to do not blame the nurses and doctors for the long stays. They say the problem appears to be much deeper. Several national organizations, including the American College of Emergency Physicians, have been advocating for systemic changes on the policy and hospital levels to tackle ER boarding. But those groups say the effort hasn't moved the needle far enough. Tracy Bolhan says the emergency room experience has stuck with her.
People didn't look at my dad as a man when we were going through the worst of it. It didn't feel to me like he was being treated with any dignity. And that, if anything could change, that would be the change that I would want to see.
More than that, caregivers like Balhan say their experiences leave them worried that the U.S. health system isn't prepared to handle a population of dementia patients that is only expected to grow. I'm Ben Thorpe, Side Effects Public Media.
That story, a collaboration between Side Effects Public Media, a health reporting collaboration of NPR member stations across the Midwest, and the Associated Press. We have more of Statewide on the way. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Electronics permeate the world. They're in almost everything we use. Charlie Schlinker visits a company that serves both farms and armed forces with made-to-order circuit boards.
Step on 1 foot on here, 1 foot on here.
To get onto the clean, airy, and well-lit production floor of the Zentech facility just off East Empire in Bloomington, you have to put heel straps on your shoes to eliminate electrostatic discharge. Industrial fans keep humidity and temperature-controlled air flowing throughout the area. They don't want to zap the electronics produced in the 95,000-square-foot section of the old IRS document distribution warehouse. The paint on the floor has an additive that prevents static from building up, and you have to wear a smock that bleeds off any charge your clothes create by rubbing together. Production manager Christy Shook points out that people hand-placing components on printed circuit boards or soldering them in place also have to plug into the desks.
You'll notice those two slots up there, one's black and one's yellow. The black one, the employees, when they're standing on there, also have to plug in. This is for a wrist strap that attaches to the smock, and it goes in, so when they're actually working on boards physically at the table, you will see areas for them to plug into.
It seems a little over the top. After all, Zentech tests everything before it leaves the plant. But marketing director Stephanie Austin says damage from static might not turn up right away.
That's the hard part about it. A latent defect, meaning it's found in the field after the fact, and it fails. In our environments that are all mission critical, that's super important to not have happen.
Zentech was founded in 1998 in Baltimore. It has another facility in Dallas. Zentech moved into its Bloomington Center in 2015, gutted the place, grounded all the pillars, and put in special flooring. They are a build-to-print firm, which means the customer has a drawing from which Zentech builds the circuit board assemblies. The boards can have everything from 10 parts to 2,000. A lot of what Zentech produces is for the military aerospace sector. Account manager Todd Jaglinski is reticent about precise products, but of the top 30 defense contractors, he says Zentech does work for 26 of them. And marketing director Stephanie Austin says the technology changes over time.
You'd have a lot of on-land equipment in Afghanistan, but now we've pulled out of Afghanistan, so then it'll be different types of drone technology that we're now working on.
Zentech also produces circuit boards for other industries. Todd Jaglinski says agricultural grain dryers, for instance.
When you're driving around central Illinois and you see the big grain silos, and they have the yellow kind of oval on top of that, so we support that customer. So the boards that we produce for them, it actually goes in and runs the drying system, so it sets the temperature, measures the humidity.
The production area is set up in a U-shape. Parts come into inventory, flow around the horseshoe through various processes, then back out the door for shipping. Jaglinski says initial printing is with a long machine that robotically inserts parts for a given board design. A bare board goes underneath a stencil.
There'll be solder paste on the top of the stencil. It'll squeegee the solder paste through the apertures on the stencil onto the board. So that's basically putting the solder paste, which is the glue that holds the components on, after solder reflow.
We passed several long multi-stage machines for what's called surface mount technology. Christy Shook says workers load components into those machines, which are programmed to place them on the printed circuit cards.
There are suction cups that pick and place all the components and place them down on a board. So it's screen printed with solder paste. It runs through there as the machine places all the parts, and by the time it comes out to the end, they recheck the components to make sure everything is good, and then it goes through a convection oven to solder it to the board.
They can make rigid flat boards and curved boards and boards that flex. There's automated quality control as well. Todd Jaglinski says Zentech recently bought a 3D automated optical inspection machine.
It's basically taking a picture of every single part on the board, and it is comparing it to a golden known good board.
The machine even does electrical tests on the parts to verify polarity, so it goes into the board the right way. It's not all automated. Sometimes components go all the way through a board or are placed above the printed card. Cindy Rutledge is the surface mount technology supervisor. She says people do that work.
If their solder joint is too close to something else and they can't get in there without disturbing the other parts around them when nobody else can get to it, quite like a person.
After surface mount placement, the circuit board goes through an oven to cause the solder to flow. And it's tricky. Todd Jaglinski says the oven needs careful Goldilocks, just right treatment. If it's not hot enough, the solder won't reflow. If it's too hot, the solder will burn off and the component won't be solidly in the board.
What we do for each product is we do an oven profile. So we have a unit that we put through that actually takes temperature readings on individual areas on an assembly. So we make sure that the whole assembly is getting the correct temperature to get proper reflow in the reflow oven.
Occasionally, something will need more direct heat than the oven can give. Those components go to hand soldering. Soldering is an art. To get the tiny amounts of metal where they need to be without spoiling things takes precision and maybe some creativity. People who like little details love this job. Logan Bartle is an up-and-coming star of soldering. He was hand soldering for a hobby and liked it.
I'm really into retro games and arcade hardware and equipment, so I got a few things and they ended up being broken. No clue how to fix them at all. So I ended up buying a cheap $30 Amazon iron and just kind of learned from trial and error.
Bartle says there's always something new and a creative new way to approach it. For instance, Bartle says recently a whole circuit trace lifted off a board.
Very, very careful. You have to take an X-Acto and just break off whatever is lifted. We have templates basically that come from a manufacturer, and then you have to glue it down by hand. And you're talking something that's probably the size of a grain of rice.
And if a board is not designed properly, hand solderers add jumper wires on the board to correct it. Logan Bartle is not the only hand solderer. Brian Wade actually has a title, fastest solderer in the world. Yes, there's a competition for that. A few years ago, he won it getting through the U.S. and Canada division before regional champs around the world came together to solder it out.
The regional is a small circuit board. You have to hand place a couple dozen parts, and it has to be soldered in compliance with IPC Class 3.
IPC Class 3 refers to high reliability electronics for mission-critical applications, say healthcare, outer space, or war. These are designed to function without failure over extended periods.
For the World Championship, we had an hour to complete it. I was done in about 35 minutes. The second place guy was done in around 53. I'm pretty fast.
Whatever comes off the production floor goes to the coating room, where Karina Strutker is the supervisor.
There are several areas on a board that do not need to be coated or are keep-out areas, so we'll need to mask those off, spray around them, and then once we spray them, we will look at them under a magnifier and find out what areas, small little areas, need to be coated, or if their coating got in the wrong area, we'll take it out.
Strutker uses a machine sprayer for silicone coating. Urethane or acrylic coating happens by hand. Everyone wears hairnets to prevent contamination. Strutker says if you like to craft or paint or do small bits of work, coating is for you. She says the challenge is to make a good-looking, quality board in a short time.
A small little board the size of a quarter is only going to take a minute. If you've got a board the size of, 12 by 12, it's going to take 40, 45 minutes just to touch it up. And then you flip it over and you'll do the other side.
She uses a blue light to check the boards before they go out. Zentech workers come from a variety of places. A couple have left for Rivian and then come back. Christy Shook used to work for a package manufacturer. Cindy Rutledge used to work for Caterpillar. Karina Strutker grew up in California on a dairy farm. Zentech was her first non-milking job. Brian Wade moved from Alton to Bloomington. He's been doing it a long time. Logan Bartle came to Central Illinois from tiny Mifflinburg, Pennsylvania, nicknamed Buggy Town. He's still in his 20s, a rarity in this field. Centec Marketing Director Stephanie Austin says the country is struggling right now to find workers, even as the federal government tries to enact policies to reshore manufacturing and make the U.S. less dependent on foreign sources. Austin says all critical infrastructure depends on electronics.
A lot of our folks in this industry are aging out, and a lot of our younger generation, though they use all of these electronics, aren't necessarily aware of the amount of complexity that goes into making them.
Austin says Zentec is trying to raise awareness and advocate for the industry to try to get kids interested in electronics, engineering, and manufacturing. It works with Heartland Community College and other training institutions, and will get workers wherever it possibly can. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
College offers young people a chance to figure themselves out and find their purpose. For Palestinian American students the past 2 years, that has meant they're doing very traditional things while bearing witness to extreme violence against their community in Gaza. For one DePaul University senior, the entire experience has tired her to the bone, but it has also helped her find her voice. Lisa Currian-Phillip reports.
3 years ago, Hannah Ayash arrived at DePaul's campus shy and a little unsure of herself. Both her parents are Palestinian, but immigrated to the United States before she was born. So Hannah grew up in a mostly white Chicago suburb where she felt like she had to hide her Palestinian identity. But at DePaul, she found a whole community of Palestinian American students. She says they taught her that celebrating her culture is a way of saying, we're still here. Now she says,
I honestly don't know who I would be if I wasn't Palestinian, because I honestly, sometimes I make it my entire personality.
Hannah and I talk outside on DePaul's quad. It's late summer in the Midwest, so you can hear the electric buzz of cicadas. I'm struck by how quickly Hannah talks and how energetic she seems, given everything that's weighing on her.
I'm a very naturally optimistic person, but also I think being in organizing spaces, you kind of have to. Because it's like, okay, so you're organizing, but if you don't think that anything can change, then what are you organizing for?
Hannah has been through a lot to get to this point. Towards the beginning of her sophomore year, on October 7th, 2023, Hamas attacked southern Israel, killing more than 1,200 people and taking more than 200 hostage. Israel responded by bombing Gaza and killing thousands of Palestinians. Israel's attacks continue to this day.
As a Palestinian living in diaspora, you feel like the guilt of how am I letting my people go through that? How am I living in America and like my tax dollars are going and funding this occupation?
With support from the United States, Israel has killed more than 65,000 Palestinians in Gaza in 2 years. United Nations recently declared that Israel is committing genocide. Israel denies the accusation. Hannah says she and her friends struggle every day with the knowledge that their country is buying bombs for Israel to drop on Gaza.
But like, I want to do something about it. Like, I have the privilege of being in America, like being and living in America. So what am I going to do about it?
Hannah says she and fellow members of Students for Justice in Palestine have focused on educating their campus about the history of Palestinians and their occupied territories. She believes they've opened the eyes of some of their classmates. Hannah says that's what made the pro-Palestinian encampment at DePaul possible in the spring of 2024. Students from different groups across campus came together for more than 2 weeks to demand their university divest from companies supporting Israel. Campus officials ultimately refused the students' demands, and after 17 days, they sent Chicago police to dismantle the demonstration. Still, Hannah says the encampment was a turning point in her education. She was tasked with talking to journalists.
The same person who could, like, barely speak in front of the classroom. Like, I had anxiety even, like, with presentations and presenting in front of people. But suddenly I was able to speak in front of other people and mics and do press conferences. And so even that, like, the organizer that I became after the encampment was an entirely, like, brand new person.
But using her voice has come at a cost. Hannah's been doxxed and falsely accused of being a terrorist by the conservative website Canary Mission. Another DePaul student has posted videos of Hannah on Instagram and YouTube alleging she's caused anti-Semitism on campus. DePaul's president has accused Students for Justice in Palestine of the same.
There's a difference between criticizing like an actual state and criticizing certain students or specific people. And we made the argument that although they might feel uncomfortable, that's very different than feeling threatened and unsafe. Obviously, that didn't go well.
Last year, Students for Justice in Palestine was banned from campus and from using DePaul's social media handles. And the ban continues this year.
On top of that, Hannah says, a lot of the international students who have supported their protests in the past are too vulnerable to continue doing so. The Trump administration has targeted Palestinian activists and their allies for detention and deportation.
A lot of people ask me this, is like, you know, are you scared of being suspended? Are you scared of being detained? But the truth is, no. Nothing scares me more than the ways in which I saw my administration react to my people in Palestine dying and going through an ongoing genocide and them working even harder to suppress us. No degree is worth the blood of my people.
Hannah arrived at DePaul 3 years ago feeling like she had to hide her Palestinian identity. Now she's committed to fighting for it and her community at any cost. Lisa Corian Phillip, WBEZ News.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for being with us. And don't forget to join us next week for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.